Darina, thanks for coming on the show. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Is it true, or are you messing with us, that you actually listen to this podcast?
It is true. I see it on Andy's LinkedIn feed, and it's absolutely true. I feel like it's very no BS, and I can use some of that spirit in my life.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you're one of the 10 people out there.
I think there are more now, but that's very kind of you. We really appreciate it. I want to ask you a little bit about your history, but I want you to go through your version first. Here's what I know from some people that we share some Canadians in common. So first of all, you started Product Hunt Toronto, which is like a really big meetup, but you're currently in San Francisco. You run Open Phone, capital P. And I think you were at something like $50 million raised, and everybody knew about it except for me, candidly. Sounds like I was out of the loop. Talk to us a little bit about the story. Give us the kind of the 10,000 foot view.
For sure. Well, I'm so happy we're chatting, and it's so great to be here. Also glad you know about it now. In terms of Open Phone, so I'm Canadian, moved to the Bay Area. Because Open Phone got accepted to YC in 2018. And really the idea came from many different places, but I'll say that this company had to start in Canada for a very simple reason, because Canadian phone bills are just insane. And yeah. I remember literally crying over my bill once. So that was the very low point in my life. But really the story of Open Phone started when my co-founder, he had a coworker who told him, "Hey, do you know you can save like 75% on your phone bill?" And I know that sounds like an infomercial, but my co-founder ended up doing that. Ported his number over from Rogers, if you know, or like Fido, to a virtual solution where your number is essentially in the cloud and you can control everything about it. And that seemed like such a brilliant, cool idea. However, the app he was using was just so bad. And, you know, both of us are product people. We kind of he started building Open Phone. I saw him building Open Phone. I said, "Hey, I'm just going to like get you customers." And also just FYI, me and my co-founder were also married. So at the time we were like in a long distance relationship. So we were on the phone all the time. And that also was interesting, because when he did the whole port thing, I was like, "Hey, your call quality is so much better." And he was like, "Yeah, this thing is so cool, but the app sucks." And that's how he started building Open Phone. And I just started getting customers. It was very much kind of like a project that became a company.
I'm fascinated by this. So first of all, everybody I know seems to use this quietly. You and I also share something in common, which is this bottom-up means of doing, I guess, go-to-market, which is actually like, I think, quite hard. Joe and I a little bit show this in common, because Joe has always worked in consumer companies. Andy, his last company was hardware and computer vision to a degree, doing baby monitors. I'm really curious about that first, I want to say, million in revenue. Getting the flywheel started is so difficult. First of all, talk to us about what eventually worked, but also like all the struggles getting from that zero to one point for you.
For sure. Well, honestly, I think it's just such a different muscle that I think I wish more founders were open to. Let me try to do this, because I know I wish more people were honest about that journey. So let me try to live
that's
by that.
That's great. Yeah, you can live live that right now.
I can try to live that right now. So honestly, what it looked like was, you know, when we started Open Phone, we always had the vision for this to be used by small businesses and startups.
Yeah.
And we saw the applicability of our solution on multiple different types of businesses. We didn't start the company to serve a specific vertical or specific type of business. So I think that added a little bit of that was great and also challenging, because a lot of our journey of zero to 1 million was actually not just selling to a specific customer type, was like constantly rediscovering what that ideal customer looks like. So a lot of the early work actually looked more like product discovery, more so than growth, but it was actually growth. I basically joined a ton of Facebook groups. I still have them on my account, which makes it unusable. I joined like almost 100 Facebook groups, a bunch of subreddits. I basically joined any community that would have me with a lot of different business owners and tried to see in what groups the problem we're solving was the most, I guess, widely recognized. Mm-hmm. There were groups where people were using existing solutions where they were like, oh man, I really wish someone built this. Thank you so much. And I could see that pull from the market. And there were groups where like I got thrown out because rightfully so, they felt I was the market.
I know the feeling.
They knew what they were doing. But it was really that. So it was a combination of trying to find in what groups there was pull. And also another part was I will share, you know, we joined YC and that helped so much because suddenly instead of me just going out there and trying to talk to all these people, we could be in a position with a lot of startups who are kind of like all going through the same thing. And a lot of startups then became our customers. So we kind of had that immersive experience of talking to a lot of potential customers in one place.
Yeah.
And that really elevated us because we were suddenly like, cool. Basically, we were able to get a bunch of folks as customers. So when I talk to someone else, I don't just say, oh, cool, like we're a new company. I can use social proof and I can rely on the fact that many people already say nice things about us. So it was basically that. It was a combination of kind of hustling one by one for every customer, but building out this network of people who are willing to recommend you and willing to say really, you know, basically give you testimonials and all of that fuel that helps you show up confident.
I'm curious about early. Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
In that early kind of growth discovery phase, what were some of the use cases that were really surprising? I'm sure you saw some things you never expected.
Yeah, I see that still. I think some of those use cases, to be honest, I was like, we are not serving that. I mean, I'll tell you this.
How many subpoenas did you have to...
Man. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you this. I'm so fortunate that we kind of... We knew this intuitively, but there's also science behind this too. Like consumer, like any consumer use case, we were just like, no.
Got it.
I'll tell you this. Here was a surprising fact. Maybe not, shouldn't be that surprising, but we initially were an iPhone app only. So a lot of our growth was limited to the fact that it was just on iPhone. And actually a lot of businesses that we wanted to sell to had people using Android as well. So a lot of our early growth techniques were optimized around getting traction on the App Store. And we had a lot of folks kind of helping us out, like App Store search optimization, you know, all of that stuff. And what we saw is like, oh, we should just like really go for keywords like second phone number. And there's a lot of volume, a lot of traction. And I was like, sure, like initially it seemed like a good idea. But a lot of those terms led to people who wanted to use open phone for things like, which is fine, like, I don't know, all kinds of like dating, just like personal things, maybe, you know, having a number that's not tied to you. So you can like message a friend and prank them. Things that, again, I just honestly wish.
Right.
Like I want to be as far from it as possible. But we kind of stumbled on that. I was like, okay, we're not running that keyword. No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was a big learning. Very, very quick one.
It very much reminds me of the early breather days where we were just like, oh God, let's make sure that it's used in the right way, right? I really felt that it was a blessing to have anyone use it ever. And then you're like, okay, well, we have to make sure that that it's working the way that we intended to. Go ahead, Andy.
I was going to say, so Julian started a drug den for people to... open phone started as the number one app for cheaters, basically, that we're getting to.
Oh, no. I will tell you this. We got that. That was the very... let's just say this. There were times I was doing customer support all the time, and I think the interesting thing is it was more like pranks, and it was like it was young individuals, kids. Basically, that was one of the things that I was like, hey, not a fan of that. We quickly learned that. The one interesting discovery, I'll tell you the one that actually had a just such a massive impact on our business was just kind of going back to the idea of like you're seeing what people do and you're trying to understand what they're really trying to use your product for. One was the fact that we had a lot of people sharing login with folks. And for us, the real reason why people were doing it is collaboration and using OpenPhone as a team was just so important. And we kind of knew it intuitively, but I think seeing that data was just like such a strong signal to say, hey, you know what? We really need to build a team experience. Mm-hmm. And that was just a major, you know, like you look at your growth, there are things you're like, what happened? That was one of those for us.
For sure.
Just creating a team's product. And I'm assuming maybe that's kind of how you're using it or a lot of people use us when they have team members, whether it's your first salesperson, you're growing your company, you want to have someone helping you out with things, support. The first person you join that joins other than you, you want to give them access to a company number. You want to give them their own number. You basically need to give them something, right? And that was just such a key thing for us. And I'm glad we launched that Teams product quickly because mm-hmm. it made it the game changer for our business.
I remember there was another version of this thing or like kind of like, I want to say 2013, 2014, a guy named Richard Kirby invested in it. And I don't remember the name, but I remember feeling around the same, which is like it's a set of anonymized phone numbers. But more broadly speaking, so it's making me think for the first time about this company. I'll find the name. But what was different between yours and others that have tried it before? Like, this is, I'm always curious. And I'm also super interested in what, like, during this early stage of this early go-to-market stage, how could you tell? It's so hard, one customer at a time. This thing that you're talking about is so difficult. And I was also wondering how you stay motivated during that process.
Yeah, I think that being motivated in that process, I think like being naive was a blessing mm-hmm. in a way. I almost wonder if, you know, honestly, your podcast and kind of talking about second time founders, I almost feel like maybe if I was a second time founder at that stage, I would have probably just been like, okay, this is, mm-hmm. there's something here. I just think there was a lot of kind of going into things without really knowing how hard they're going to be. Maybe I see that in this case as a positive. But in terms of your question, what is different? Frankly, this space, like this is what everyone tells me. They're like, when I hear about your product, it seems like it already exists. It should exist. Or mm-hmm. And yes, we have. It's the market is busy. There are a lot of competitors. What makes us different, I think, fundamentally in the core is we are product people. We're really obsessed about customer experience and UX. It sounds like a small thing, but I think our competitors struggle where they started the company when the world worked different and their stack and everything they do, they just have a lot of kind of like debt in terms of design, in terms of product, in terms of just like their technology. They have to support all these customers. And what we have as an advantage is the fact that we can build a solution that makes sense for the way businesses are run today. Mm-hmm. And we can, I think that's just such a huge thing. Plus we are, again, being product people, we care so deeply about UX, about every interaction you have with a product. Mm-hmm. And that level of focus on the product experience just hasn't made it to this industry. So, we get to bring something that is such an expected thing from other industries. Like there is Slack, right? It's a modern UX. You're used to certain interactions. But when it comes to business telephony, it looks like it's from 1990s. Yeah. So we have ability to bring it. We have ability to bring modern UX principles and concepts to the world that's just so behind.
Yeah, no, we're a customer. We don't use your team product. I think we're just like a one or two seat customer. But I'll give you some, and this is a plug for your company because this is all real. So we signed up for RingCentral nobody could figure out how to get that thing set up. It was crazy. There were like all these configurations and flows and like for stuff that none of us wanted. And like finally I just gave up. Then we signed up for OpenFund Startup Program where they give it away for you for free. And then we couldn't get that working for some reason. They would never figure out to activate us. They just kept sending us emails.
Oh, sorry. That was a different company, right? Is that OpenFund?
Oh, Dialpad.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. We signed up for Dialpad. And then finally, we just gave up and signed up for you. And it was, voila, we have a phone number and we're done. And so it was actually like super easy.
It seems like such a bullshit thing, right? It seems like people say UX, I'm like, this is a fake answer. But it sounds as if there were two things that happened. One is you made it simple for people to use to a much bigger degree. But the second one is you pivoted into a lower churn set of customers. Would you say that was a big influence in your success or getting off the ground, so to speak?
Yeah, I think so. I think actually I'll put it this way. There is when people say UX, and I'm with you because sometimes I struggled with this too. I'm like, we win because of UX. People are like, what are you talking about, DS, right?
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that there is UX, which is making it much, I think you have to be 10x better in terms of product experience. But I think for our case, it's that plus much, much easier to just sign up. I think to Andy's point, people kind of oversee this. Sometimes it's kind of a, hey, our go-to-market motion. At the end of the day, we are a bottoms-up company where just like what happened with Andy, right? Andy can sign up quickly, add his team, and kind of add licenses, grow with us as his company grows.
Yeah.
Versus a lot of what our competitors do is they actually don't do this part well. They are building the product more for enterprise and more for larger companies,
mm-hmm.
where they're actually missing out on the fact that they can get a company when it's just like just starting. And we want to be a solution essentially that you set up when you incorporate and that grows with you.
Yep.
And it's really our go-to-market motion. It's so easy. The pricing makes sense. Adding users makes sense. So there's more to it than just UX. It's also our pricing model and our onboarding experience, which makes such a big difference, I think.
I also heard that you never had a free plan. Is that right?
Yes.
Talk to me about that decision.
Oh, yeah. I hope one day we can have a pre-free plan. I think it's one of those things where... prior to this, I was a product manager at a company where I built like a Vidyard. I built a free product there and I love the experience of doing it so much. I'm a huge believer in freemium, obviously, and having not just having a free trial, but having a free plan.
Mm-hmm.
So I want us to have a free plan. It's there's a lot to consider. First of all, our product has real costs. There's a real cost behind sending messages. There is a real cost behind phone calls. There's a real cost of having a number. There's like real, real cost associated with it. And right now, you know, we have a free trial. We have amazing trial conversion. We have certain things that are so good that I almost feel like adding a free plan right now is going to, it's a matter of making it work, but also...
Yeah.
It's also about a bit distracting. We are, as a company, you know, we have a certain size of our engineering team and we have customers who tell us really clearly all the gaps we have and where we need to work on. And
mm-hmm.
I think at a certain size it will make sense, but right now it's a bit of a distraction and also the economics of it are very murky for us.
I'm just going through the same thing, a similar experience. Like we're running a model internally. We know when someone drops onto our site from various places, we know what their credit card input is. We ask for a CC today, no matter what. And we know their conversion rates. And there is this seductive nature of free plans. And everywhere on the internet, people teach you, probably including YC, they probably say to you, free, 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 get usage, free, free, free. And it sounds like you had a separate experience and you went straight for cash.
Yeah. Well, I think that I'll tell you one thing is it's also harder when you start. So first of all, when we just started Open Phone, like we started making money before YC, and we didn't really even know if we're going to be able to. That's like a separate probably podcast about getting funding. We felt like we can't rely on investors funding this business. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be able to make money. So kind of
sure.
Simple. Yeah. And we also, I think actually, I will tell you that YC, one of the early pieces of advice was actually a bit different. It was about charging for the product. So I think it maybe depends, like advice kind of varies on the company. But the advice that was given to us specifically was you guys have to charge, you have to charge more. So that was the advice we were getting. It's also, by the way, right? Like once you get on a certain path, it's hard to say, okay, well,
yes.
We have all these people making money. We have this whole thing. We have this roadmap to do. We have customers demanding things. By the way, we're now going to allocate a third part of our engineering team towards this free plan or, and then by the way, you can't just have a free plan. You need to have like very strong lifecycle marketing and programs to get people moved from free to paid. And I think that as a company, one thing I've learned is that focus is so key. We can't right now, we can't afford to, it's less about the money, it's more about the focus. Can't afford to split our team into the team working on this B2B side and then a team who is just creating this free package.
From the perspective of now being at the place where you've financed this business like a fair amount, what would you say was the biggest challenge in terms of like, what is the phase that was the hardest to you past your like maybe 5 or 10 employees? What would you say like was the biggest challenge as a founder and as an operator?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The phase that was first of all, I think that generally like even before we made any hires, that was incredibly hard. That was incredibly hard, but also now that I look back, it was so fun. I feel like the sometimes the hard parts come with also just so much growth. So that was let me put that aside. I think generally one of the hard parts, we're probably kind of hitting that point now, is we have a pretty fairly big team. We have we have a lot going on. We have customers like customers needing things, just kind of like everything needs to happen. I feel like right now it's pretty hard because it's a lot about prioritization and it's a lot about saying no to things. I think this is a challenging part because before it was like, well, we can do these things, we just need more people. But I think now it's about, well, at some point you just can't say yes to everything. Really ruthless prioritization is needed. And that's the phase we're in right now. And it is hard.
It breaks down. You can for a while ask to hire, but then at some point you can no longer do that. Joe?
So Julian and I, and Andy probably sooner, maybe Anani, like raise these big growth rounds at some point in the history of our companies and found the conversations and pressures changed in a major way around the boardroom. You guys raised a pretty big round, like, you know, last year, 22, right? How are you still in the honeymoon phase on that? Or have you felt the like pressure increase and how has that ride so far been?
I will tell you this, and I don't know if this is a common answer. I feel like sometimes I feel like I put more pressure on myself than kind of anyone. I almost feel like that's just been, for me personally, like a character trait. So if anything, the internal pressure I put on myself in any situation is greater than kind of like anything external. And because of... So I think that's what's happening for sure. And I'm working on that and trying to figure that out. But in terms of the change it has made to our company or kind of like conversations in the boardroom, I wouldn't say so because because I think we've always had that kind of that focus. And again, I think that there is nothing that someone can tell me that I feel like I am already putting myself through so much here that anything external can't compete with that.
Yeah, it's such a. I don't know if this resonates with the panel here, but like, if you raise your hand, if you ever had a private equity firm come onto your board, and all of a sudden the dynamic was different than the early stage people. For me, it was really, really big. It's like early stage people have certain expectations and they're like, yeah, we'll figure this out. Like, you guys are doing great. And then private equity comes in and the standards are way different. And all of a sudden your reporting is different. Everything you do has to be almost like at a different standard. I remember having to almost like remind private equity people that this was an early stage company, you know?
Yeah. I think the, we fortunately, we don't have that. And we have an amazing board. I think the thing is that I just generally find a lot of companies have pressure. Maybe they do this themselves too. They kind of grow up too quickly. And that's like one thing I kind of keep in my head a lot is this balance of knowing where you need to create processes and where you need to like essentially grow up, and where growing up too early means it kills innovation and kills that special sauce that made your company work. Just like you talking about it makes me think about it. I always ask myself, like, okay, is this like just a natural part of growing up, or is this a beginning of something which can kill like that special thing that we have to do what we do, which really got us here?
I don't know if this resonates with you, but we find sometimes that when someone is running a current business, it's impossible for them to really talk about it in the same way as they ran an old business. It's like, I would ask you something like this. I would say, what's one of the biggest mistakes you ever made while you were running this business? It's very difficult for you to answer honestly. Be curious to hear about it. But that said, here's an alternative question. Who is someone that helped you a great deal now that you're in San Francisco, even though they had no need to do so?
Both are great questions. I could actually even tackle the first one, but let me not get too ambitious first. Let me tackle the second one. There were people throughout there are people throughout the history of our company who opened doors and helped when they really not even didn't have to, but when it was like, yeah, it was not even rational to do so. So I think the earliest probably is, we went through a program at Velocity in Waterloo in Kitchener. And Jay Shaw, who admitted us there, I think he kind of, he saw something in us and he saw something in what we're building, and he was very, very supportive. And it's kind of like, there's a multitude of different things he has done, but I just feel like being in a place where you can kind of see that there's someone who believed in you, that on its own was so helpful. This goes back to the earliest days. I mean, at that time, there was really nothing. And I feel like he really opened doors for us. There was a founder who, I don't know if he necessarily wants me to say this, but and to talk about him specifically, but I will say there is a person who made an enormous amount of introductions to investors. You know how when you talk to folks who are like, hey, I'll put you in touch with my investors? Well, this person actually did. He literally sent emails to every single investor who invested in him, saying, hey, there's this company, they're doing something cool, I believe in it, you should talk to them. And those emails resulted in us meeting someone who ultimately then introduced us to the person who led our seed round.
Yeah.
And to me, what the biggest thing was like that incredible generosity. I hope I can do that to someone else, like literally opening their book and saying, let me introduce every single person here and you are like a newcomer to the Bay Area, you're like, oh, wow. Like, that's crazy. Like, it's almost like winning a lottery.
Andy, has that ever happened to you? Joe, has that ever happened to you? It's never happened to me. I'm just being totally honest.
Yeah, actually, it has. I have a few people like that on my cap table. I have a lot of people who don't do that, but I actually have. That's definitely happened to me.
Yeah,
I have a few famous folks who would wish to rename nameless who pretty much send emails to every tier one VC for me.
Wow,
and to like the head of the firm.
How do you find someone like that?
I've told you about him privately. I won't say it publicly. I don't know. I got lucky, but I also have a ton of these like small social media type VCs. Julian, I know you have some of them too.
Yeah.
And those I find to be the worst.
Yeah, Julian, it's going to happen to you. I feel like it's, I think this is one of those things you can't, I just believe it will happen kind of organically. Just throwing it out there in the universe. Let's manifest it.
That's good.
One of these days, there's going to be someone who makes you feel like, wow.
I had someone way back when, early days, who tried to charge for introductions.
Oh, yeah. We've all had one of those. Yeah, it's awful.
I thought that was unique to me.
No way. No, there's so many grifters out there. Joe?
Yeah. Well, Julian, you're in the position now to be that person.
Yeah, you're right. And I do it. It's just that, you know, sometimes you have these people. And again, like, I think we all in our head, we have someone that we know like this, someone who we know someone. And I will not name this person. I've known them for quite a long time. It's when I'm like, hey, could I get an intro? And they're like, no, I need this relationship too much right now. I can't do it. And it's just, I don't know. It's interesting because whenever people move to Silicon Valley, Kevin is the same, who's usually on this thing. And Doreen, I hear the same from you. It's like, when you move to Silicon Valley, good things happen, blah, blah, blah. Joe, I know your experience coming from Las Vegas is a little bit similar. Maybe it's just a Silicon Valley thing and we're not close enough to it.
No, definitely good to tap into that network. Curious, something you brought up at the very beginning that's been kind of pinging around in my head is, I didn't realize your husband is your co-founder.
Oh, yeah.
And, this is such an intense journey. I find my wife is like my escape from it. How is that, how do you guys support each other? What is that like? How does it impact the culture of your company? Just whatever, obviously what you're comfortable sharing, but that's like an amazing, rare thing, I feel like.
Well, sure. Well, first of all, I think I thought it was a very rare thing too. Until moving to the Bay Area, I actually find so many people in this position. So that was interesting because I think in Canada, it almost felt like this was super rare. But here I kind of feel, I know a lot of people on this type of journey. Frankly, to me, it's been such an intense experience. I think that I actually don't imagine. I guess there are definitely tough parts in this, and as you kind of alluded to, the fact that you're always thinking about business, you're always thinking about work. It's kind of like around you all the time. That's tough. But I find there are so many positives. And I think that there were a lot of people kind of in the earlier days who were kind of telling me we're crazy to do it and et cetera, et cetera. But I think the difference is that we really committed to making it work. And we approached it with like, hey, we love working together. We have complementary skill sets. Like, we're going to make it work. And we focus on a lot of the positives, which I think far, far, far outweigh the negatives. I think I'm actually worried for folks who have co-founders who they don't know very well, that to me is crazier, to be honest.
Would you ever
do it? I actually think we would work with my wife.
Yeah.
My wife's, Julian's met her briefly. Kevin, Joe has not.
I see it. I do.
I could see it working with my wife. My wife is a badass. And she works in tech. I'm just not sure she'd kill me. but she would definitely be every day pushing us to move faster.
Here's the feeling that I have is, if it were ever to happen, the people that I think of are, I think her last name is Olivieri, Stephanie Olivieri and Michael Cho, who started Unsplash. And Unsplash ultimately sold to either Shutterstock or one of those, like Spaghetti maybe, for a fair amount of money, I think. And I remember at the time thinking, well, if you're in, you're in, because like there's no way, like you have to make the working relationship work, because I mean, it's not really a question, it's more of a comment, because it, maybe if the working relationship doesn't work, then the personal relationship will suffer. And so it's a, like you're forced to continue to work together. You're
the whole thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
You're all in. There's no question about it. I also think you're going through a lot as a founder. You're going through so many ups and downs, and the fact that you know what your partner is going through, and you know, the empathy you have for each other is at a different level. But I think there are a lot of positives. I would just say they, definitely not for everyone. Definitely not. I feel like if someone's like, I'm not sure if I should do it, then don't do it. I think it's only for people who, it's only for crazy people who are like, this is what I'm doing. They can believe it.
Yeah.
It can only work in that case. And we've been doing this for a long time now. I think that earlier days, I was like, oh my God, what are we doing? But at this point, we've developed rituals, habits, and the fact that I would just highlight the fact that we have complementary skill sets really helps. I find a lot of founders, no matter how they know each other, it's tough when there's a lot of overlap. Like that kind of stuff where it's almost like there's a question like, who is responsible for this area? And there's like almost a question in mind, like, well, it shouldn't be me, shouldn't it be you? And I remember seeing the other day on Twitter, I forgot who tweeted this, but there was a comment about every startup needs to have basically a hacker, a builder, and a seller / hustler. I don't like the word. I mean, let's not comment about those words.
Sure.
But I am totally like a hustler, seller. Like here I am on this podcast. Like I love just sales and marketing is my jam. I absolutely love it. Like sending cold emails makes me happy. Like, it's weird. My co-founder is like the opposite of it. Like what needs to do happen for him to like, get on a podcast. But I think that's what it's so cool about it.
Was there ever a decision about who would be CEO, or was it obvious?
He came up with the idea, and he, you know, I think the idea came from him, and he, you know, this is something that like he was already actually thinking about starting a company and like building something. So he was in that like exploration mode. For me, it was that when he was exploring it, I saw an opportunity. Like I saw that there is a big gap around like how do we get customers. And we didn't necessarily think of it right away. Like, okay, we're building a company together. It was just more, I think it was natural and something, you know, there was a journey that I wanted to have, and there was a journey that he wanted to have, and our understanding for what that journey is for each of us coincided. But yeah, would have been a problem if it was combative, like, well, I want to do this, you want to do this as well. We were very naturally, we naturally fell into what we wanted for ourselves outside of just, outside of the company.
Got it. And so now, like, I'll just give you a common experience for when I talk to founders. You must talk to a lot. Early stage founders, when they come to you, and I'm sure some of them do, one of the top things personally that I always say is you're a consumer company, should probably be a business oriented company instead. And I'm wondering if you would give the same feedback to most kind of like bottom up type of businesses, or whether there's some other kind of point of feedback that you really, really give people super commonly when you're asked.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think what is the common piece of feedback. I feel like I talk to people from so many different stages of company building. Honestly, the one thing I always talk about, and I'm sure you're all going to agree, is just the importance of hiring the right people. I find that whether it's someone who is still pretty early and they're like looking for their, let's say, you know, first hire, first couple of hires, I mean, those are incredibly important. Or even someone at a critical pivot, like pivotal stage of their business. The one piece of feedback slash, I think a theme that, I don't know if it's a piece of, it's more of a theme that just keeps coming back, which is the importance of hiring. And the one thing I wish I maybe had more experience in is, you know, I feel like if I had more experience hiring folks prior to Open Phone, I probably would have an easier time. I just think it's hard and makes such a huge difference on the trajectory of your business, bringing on the right person versus making a wrong hire that sets you back by minimum.
How do you know when you found someone that's the right person?
Oh, for the $1 million question. I think, I feel like I have just personally refined the way I think about the way I think about really testing and kind of like screening for the right thing. I think that one opinion I have now is that hiring, there are a lot of people who can be really good at interviewing, but not necessarily good at kind of like what they actually do. So I think that what I'm trying to do,
right,
and this is an ongoing journey, is trying to better differentiate, is this person just so good at interviewing versus they're really good versus someone who is absolutely amazing, can do great work, but they happen to not be good at interviewing. I actually think of myself, like, I don't really think I'm that good at interviewing. I can see people who do like such an amazing job, and you have to wonder which one it is. And I think a lot has to go back to really asking questions and really diving into their past experience to really understand like what they've been able to do. Trying to really distinguish between talking versus doing. That's my big.
It's so big. Joe, you have the best alumni of anyone here.
Yeah, I mean, I got destroyed on that building file. Just the, you know, being so excited when I would meet somebody and like, oh my gosh, this person is interested in maybe a job here. Like, go 100% in the sales mode. And then the more senior they are, the better they are at selling themselves. And the harder it is to tease out what they actually did versus like what scenario they were in. Like, you put people in, you know, a company with incredible product market fit, they're going to likely succeed, and what playbook they think they're going to run versus like, you know, your company. And oh my gosh, the amount of just like pain and mistakes I made through that, you know, got some right. We do have an amazing alumni from Clout, and but a lot of broken eggs to get there.
Totally. I think the something that I reflect on is, especially I remember like very early days, kind of like similar sentiment to like, oh my God, there's someone who wants to work here. Like, wow, that's crazy. Like that's like a huge moment of celebration on its own. And I think that I definitely have gone through this phase, and I know it's common, but you know, the shiny resume, right? When you see folks coming through with like just incredibly amazing resumes, and you're like, wow, like, you know, I look at my resume, but yeah, like, wow, this person wants to be here. And really, really trying to understand, just going back to what does your company really need, and not getting blindsided by that. But I just find myself now kind of thinking a lot through like, what do we actually need? And there are times when you need people with certain experience. So you totally go and say, hey, I need someone with this type of experience. It's a must. Versus knowing where you want, like, again, just knowing when you are strong on like, hey, this experience is a must. Versus I think a lot of times the best hires are folks who completely kind of like redefine your expectations of the role. And I think that's like, that's what everyone here wants. Like, you want people who actually say, hey, your expectations for this role were completely not right. Here, let me define this role. And you're like, wow, that is what great looks like.
I'm very curious to ask the panel, we'll start with you, Andy, the best person that you've ever hired. Okay, it's the first part. Second is, did you know they would be that good? And how did you find them? So that's the question. Who they were, did you know they would be that good at the beginning, and how did you find them? Go ahead.
Are we naming names?
You can if you want. We'll go around.
I'm not going to name names, but it's somebody I am still very close with. I met them at a dinner in 2009 when I was still in venture. Maybe it was 2010. I stayed in contact on and off. I brought them in as an advisor first. I brought them in as a key executive role at Nanit. Did not realize how good they would be. Had a CEO type resume, and blew me away at how gritty and in the weeds operationally they could be with a small team. And we have stayed in contact and have done things afterwards. And I call them about my business all the time. That is the one, though, out of like 100 like that I've ever seen, because I think everyone else hires that person, that stellar, amazing resume, and they are not like that. And I've tried to replicate that since, and it has been hard.
Dorina, go for it.
Yes. Look, and by the way, this is not just me being like, hey, this is a podcast. I truly believe we've made a lot of really great hires. We've made mistakes, of course, but we've made a lot of really great hires. And because you know it, because we are in such a competitive space. We had such a, you know, there were so many parts of the journey that were really tough, and it was because of the team we built that we were able to make it here. I would say that the way I've gone about recruiting is, I think initially I had this idea that like, okay, I'm hiring for this role. I need to find people in this role. This is my current priority. So let me go and talk to people specifically in this role. But what I've learned as we've grown is that people who I met like 3 years ago, 4 years ago, just who I kind of met through different circumstances, events or introductions, maybe people who are also founders who are working on something. Now, like 4 years later, I nurtured some of these relationships. I'm like, man, when I need a person in this department, I already know like 3 or 4 people who are incredible. And I think that was the biggest change, is that just always talking to people, being open, being just genuine about meeting people and getting to know them. Because I definitely learned that I can't expect to just like out of the blue, here, let me go and kind of like hire for a role. It's really a lot of past relationships that you nurture that connect you to folks. So it's less, it's a long-term game. It's not a start and stop. Hey, I need a person for this role.
Joe?
Yeah, I think that idea of investing in these relationships over a long arc for getting to know awesome people that can land in your company later when you grow into it, or when the needs arise or timing align, is just awesome advice and definitely something that's worked well for me. Yeah, there's almost 100% the best people I've worked with never look the best on paper. And it's those people that have taken those left turns and had bumpy roads and worked at companies that failed, or, you know, whatever yellow flag might appear on their resume, so often is what makes them stronger and able to like power through the challenges we all face in our startups. So I love getting to know people over a long arc and then making bets on people who, you know, on paper don't have the like pedigree to like for the responsibility you're giving them, but come in and just crush it.
I just give my experience. I went from having essentially almost never hired anyone, before Breather, really, to having a super flip-floppy instinctive process, which was total bullshit. And looking back on it now, I had no idea what I was doing, to now having like a 10-point scale that I rate everybody on. I demand everybody else rate everyone on. And then we go through it and we have a discussion about these 10 points. The number one thing that I've noticed is enthusiasm to do the job trumps everything. Like you could be dumber. You could be any number of different things. But if you have that enthusiasm and you just work it pump and you're thinking about it off hours and like all these things, it compensates for so much.
Huge. That's a huge one. And that took me a bit to understand too. Because one of the things that I relate to it so much is because fundamentally they're going to be downs. They're going to be ups and downs. And if you're not into it, you're going to, like, those downs are going to be really hard for you because maybe you don't find the role, the company, whatever you're doing that exciting. Mm-hmm. You're just going to quit during those downs.
A bit of a random question. Go ahead.
I hired someone off Indeed that showed up to an interview in a suit and tie at a startup that has worked with me on and off for 7 years and ended up being a VP from like a marketing associate. And it has just been like this incredible hustler. So like I am all about giving people chances. I wish I had a better skill to determine what actually makes them successful, which I think would be very interesting.
I'm getting sharper about it, but we still make mistakes. That's the part that I find the most troubling. You know, I think it was Mark Andreessen who's like, even when you interview people really well with executives, you got a 50% hit rate. I find that depressing. I don't know about you.
I think it's probably right, to be totally honest. If you're good at this, it's 50. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a good manager, you're a good CEO, what do you think? How many decisions right in a week you're getting right? 55%, 53?
Yeah.
It's maybe. So brutal. Making those decisions.
Yeah,
but it's a growing. The job is always changing too. I think this is the part that's tough, right? Like you interview someone. Let's say you interview someone. You do a great job. Like you come in super prepared. You know what you're doing. You're gonna find the right person. But then if the company trajectory changes, like things that change about your business, about the market, or really anything external, suddenly you hired the right person, but the board has shifted. So what are the chances they're still the right person for this new evolution, right?
Mm-hmm. Joe?
No, she nailed it. That was exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
It's also about like someone who's going to be right for that year, and they might not be right in year two as much, and they might not be in year three as much. And there is this funny thing where you're like, so, a year from now, this person is going to be great. But it's too bad because I need this person immediately and I need them to solve problems today, right? I see you nodding.
Oh, yeah. I think the one thing I also find is that at the end of the day, a startup, like, what is the success rate? What is the failure rate of startups? You have to, as much as we all want to, I mean, we are long-term minded, but at the end of the day, you are every month you are, essentially, you need to survive as a business. You need to be able to have if someone is going to be creating value a year from now, then like what's the guarantee you're going to get to that point? You need people who can create value today.
It's a very good point.
This is out of the ordinary for us to be asking, but all of us here have raised something like 50 plus more $1 million and have been operators for a long time. What is something that you want to know that maybe we know? Like, what are you going through at the moment that is maybe something that we have experience doing?
How much time do we have?
Yeah.
Well, I will, multiple things. So, what I'm very curious about is the, I mean, a lot about it is not to plug anything here, we are hiring a VP of marketing. That's actually one of my
big one
to get to, yeah. Here we are. What I'm really curious about is, I mean, I'll actually just ask that question. You've probably hired for this role in your companies. Everyone tells me how different this process is from other exec roles.
Yeah.
What comes to mind in terms of mistakes you've made or things you've learned about this specific hiring process?
I have trauma about marketing. Joe, why don't you start?
You know what? I actually don't feel like I have good input here since being consumer side, like the kind of marketing motion you need in your business is just very different than anything I've done. So I'm curious, Andy and Julian, I feel like you'll have a much better take.
So I'll go at it like this on VP of marketing. I think there are a lot of different type of people who fall into a marketing org. And I think it's taken me a long time to learn this one. It really matters what your go-to-market strategy is to some degree. There are people who are incredibly good at crafting messages and incredibly good at doing story and narrative. And that's a very special type of person. And then there are people who are very good at almost like demand gen and to some degree CRM and life cycle. Very rarely do you find that person together. And so you have to determine what is really the most important thing, the brand articulation, the messaging, the how do we do it, the how do we describe it and how do we take it to the next level versus like, how do we build an engine? And I lean towards the side of how do you build it? But that's just me because I've been always heavily, very much growth marketing driven.
That resonates with me. I will say I've spent like something like $1 million on subway ads in New York City. You know, like I've done that all the way to the opposite of that, whatever that is. And I will say that my current, like my perspective is like, I want my person both in product and I want my person in marketing ideally to be able to run a financial model. Like if someone has a background partially in finance, I'm like, you are the person for me. Like I flip out about those people, maybe a bit more than I should. But the reason is that they are so, first of all, they're rare, but their likelihood that they're deluding themselves, because marketing is so much about like, getting people to believe in things and making, getting attention for cheap, that being able to back things up with a financial model and getting your reasoning to be questioned by a financial model is a gigantic amount of how I think about that person. And it's so tough because the average VP marketing hire we know is something like a year. And so it's a super, super tough thing. And then the last thing I would say, which I've said before on this podcast, is always hire recruiters to increase your likelihood of getting people.
Absolutely. Like excellence in recruiting. And this is maybe one thing I wish I knew earlier too. It takes, for example, one of the biggest lessons going back to, let's say the point that we started hiring and needing to build the org was that you need a great recruiter, you need a great recruiting team. We're very fortunate now. So I think we'll be good. I feel like if we ever do a follow-up or something, I'll let you know how it goes. But
yeah, for sure.
It's a more nuanced point though. We're going to tell you this, and we all very much here believe this. Hire an external, like retained search, like tier one firm if you're doing a VP marketing role.
Yeah. Definitely. It's so important just to get more people in the pipeline. I have repeat founders that I know. Joe, you and I somehow know all of the Andrew Chen's companies for some reason. They're like all friends of ours through one person or another. One of them is the ex-founder of Sonder, who did not stay there, not Francis, the CEO, but the other one who's running a company. And he does a retained search for literally every person he hires. Doesn't matter who they are. If they're a marketing manager, if they're like some rando copywriter, it doesn't matter. He retains a search firm.
Does he have one on retainer at all times, or how does he do it?
Yeah, he does. And I know who it is, and I'll tell you offline. But he does do that for every single role. It's wild.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's how PE does it. If you if you go work with a middle market PE or a large cap bio firm, the first thing they do for some of these roles, anything like BP, is just like get a search firm.
Of course.
Let's see who's out there.
Dorina, thank you for coming on with us. It's a great way to end the podcast. And it's great to be able to chat with you, and congrats on all your success and your upcoming success that we have yet to see.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful. Thanks for having me. We keep it real and we bring you the facts. It's the Second Time Founders Podcast. Talking tech news, the show is a must. Not some billionaire trying to sell you their book. We're coming from a real place, plenty ups and downs. Got some insights, join the discussion now. We being honest and raw, giving you real talk. We've been at the bottom and made it happen and much more. The Second Time Founders Podcast. More building, less talk.